Greetings, everyone, and welcome back to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Today is Friday, June 13th, 2025, and this is episode 121. We are now full into summer here in Nashville. Temperatures are warming up, and we have seen our first brood of bluebirds fledge last week. We had a superabundance of rain this spring, and so everything is wonderfully green. I grew up in Ohio, and in Ohio it was required that eighth graders have a course on the history and geography of the state. We learned about the Buckeye and the Cardinal and the different regions and agricultural crops. We learned about prominent rivers and landscape features. It was interesting. Is such a course required in Tennessee? I don't know. When I moved to Tennessee, I had to learn about Tennessee without the benefit of that eighth grade course. And I was lucky to have the opportunity to travel all around the state and to learn its lore on the firsthand basis. It also helped to work in an agency charged with resource conservation and with many people with highly specialized knowledge and insight. As I talk with people in the course of day-to-day life here in Nashville, I'm frequently surprised to find that many people have not visited or experienced our Tennessee treasures, such as Pinson Mound, Real Foot Lake, or Roan Mountain. Perhaps I need to do more to promote these wonderful places. Among the jewels on our Tennessee landscape, which every Tennessean should experience, are the precious cedar glades, which occur most prominently in the hard scrabble area around Lebanon, Tennessee. These areas are subtly beautiful and home to many truly rare plants and plant communities, not found anywhere else in the world. On today's program, I speak with Dr. Kim Sadler, professor at the University, Middle Tennessee State University, Center for Cedar Glade Studies, and we learn about their efforts to conserve these areas and to educate our citizens about these special places. I hope our conversation will be inspirational and to you and to get you out to explore the Cedar Glades of Tennessee. And we will get started right after this brief message.
Hi, this is Heather Lose, Editor-in-Chief of the Tennessee Conservationist Magazine. Every year, we publish 6 beautiful issues packed full of timely and informative stories about Tennessee culture, people, and places. You can stay informed about your world and all the great things happening in your Tennessee state parks. It's easy to subscribe. Just go to our website at tnconservationist.org. Thank you.
Kim Sadler, welcome to the Mark Fraley Podcast. Great to see you this morning.
Oh, I know that people listening that they can't see us, but it's great to be in conversation with you.
Fun. And I love your background. It looks like the Tennessee coneflower back there in your background.
It is. It's right. It's in its full glory. So this is our Tennessee conservation really success story. You know, we think about things in nature and the news, and it's like it's all bad, Dad. But this isn't. This is a real story, real success.
I hope we can get into that story a little bit. We chatted a little bit before we went on the record, and there's a lot. There are some good stories involved with the Tennessee coneflower that are illustrative of citizen scientists and people that are out there trying to make things happen. So, So Kim, you are with the Middle Tennessee State University Center for Cedar Glade Studies. And I want to talk all about that and let my listeners hear about that organization and what you're doing. But as we get started, it's kind of a tradition on this program to start by talking about my guest a little bit and your background and because I'm always curious, and my listeners are curious about how people that choose the path of being in a conservation-related field, how they choose that as a career path. And so tell us about yourself, your influences, and how you got into biology, and go for it. Tell us a little bit about that.
I am the daughter of an Air Force fighter pilot,
Good
and we
gracious.
had the privilege of traveling in many, many different places around the world that my father's job took us. And one thing that he always did, wherever it is that we moved, he would plant like a flower garden. We'd always have something, geraniums or impatiens, or it was something that he did very intentional. One place we lived in Michigan, we won the Yard of the Year award or something. So just a magnitude of that. So I have to say that my dad was an influence in getting me to look at things. And I have four other siblings. So our family of seven, we'd pile in the station wagon and we'd be going from one place to another. And he'd pull the car over en route, and we all had to get out of the car and stand there and look at something in nature that caught his eye. And when you're a kid, you're sort of like, yeah, whatever. But
Right,
you
right.
know, it was, I
So,
didn't
did your
realize
dad
that.
have specific training in the
No,
out of doors, or?
not at all. Not at all. Other than, whatever the military would bring to the table. So I have to say it started there. And then, when you go to college, there are courses that are required. We call them general education. And I was flopping around as a freshman. I thought I wanted to, quote unquote, wanted to be a physician. And was really lucky to pass my freshman year because I realized I was the first time I was ever away from home.
And
But
where were you in college?
at that time, I was at a private university, Stetson University in
Stetson, okay.
Tillian, Florida.
Yeah,
Yeah.
yeah.
So then sophomore year, they actually didn't kick me out. I took a biology class, and it was just like everything the professor said made sense to me. I mean, I was holding on for dear life. I think I earned a C in the course, well deserved. But we did wonderful things when we studied ecosystems. We went to the forest, we went to the fields, we went to the beach because the school was close to the beach. And we studied all of these different aspects of it. When we looked at animal behavior and physiology, the mice came out and we injected them with different hormones and we collected data. And it's like, I love this. And so that was it. I mean, I was hooked. And I guess I could be a real proponent of the general education curriculum because otherwise, had I
You
not
wouldn't have been
had that
exposed to
course,
that,
yeah, it was
sure. Right,
required.
right.
And ultimately, if I was going to be a physician, I would have ended up in a biology course. But to me,
Sure,
that was my
yeah.
moment of inspiration.
So you went on to get higher education in biology.
I did, and then I ended up. I transferred up to Tennessee and decided that I loved it here. I had friends here that to me, this is the most beautiful state. And I've traveled at that point in my life. I traveled to a lot of different places in the world and within the United States. And to me, this is just beautiful. I just had everything, the forest and the lakes and the rivers and the streams and the mountains and just so many different species of things to explore and investigate. And so I did go on to graduate school and then just kind of continued in biology. So it's been really exciting to be. I don't really feel like I work. I feel like this is all part of who I am.
And so your focus of specialty is in botany. Is that fair to say,
I have a really strong background in botany and took all of the botany courses that MTSU offered. But my doctorate is in education. So
Oh,
I have this
okay.
really great kind of blending of biology with the plant emphasis, ecology, and education. And it's really served me well in terms of trying to distill these ideas, these complicated ideas, or sometimes complicated seeming ideas in biology to the general public.
Right.
And so I see myself as somebody who's able to make that transition.
Well, it makes perfect sense for a person who's at a university to be an educator. I mean, doesn't
Well, it does, but
it? Yeah.
really our mission, of course, is teaching, but it's also research as well. So
Sure,
about
sure,
that.
sure, sure. All right. So this morning I was in conversation with a person at the pool where I go for swimming laps in the morning, and let it be known that I was going to interview a person about cedar glades today, and the individual had no idea in the world what a glade was, much less a cedar glade. And so I'm wondering, can we start with, so you're the Center for Cedar Glade Studies,
Well,
can
I'm
we
yeah,
Can
co-director. I have a partner as
well,
well.
pardon me. So you're
Yeah.
with that organization that involved with Cedar Glades. What's a Cedar Glade? And let's get that basic about it, because I think people don't know.
I teach these large lecture sections that number from 100 to 235 students, and always inquire on the first day, how many of you all have heard of a cedar glade? And these are students generally from Middle Tennessee, and very few of them raise their hand to say they know what a cedar glade is. Have you
That's
heard of a
astounding.
cedar glade? Maybe a few more,
Right.
but it is interesting. We are in the heart of limestone cedar glades here in Middle Tennessee. So cedar glades are not unique just to Middle Tennessee. There's cedar glades all over, but limestone cedar glades are here where we live. And what these places are is it's where there's these limestone rocks that they belch up. You could see them generally flat, but in some places, they're outcroppings. So
Right.
we've got these flat rocky limestone areas, some areas with outcroppings, interspersed with soil that has accumulated to varying depths because of the geology. So the geology of the area here in Middle Tennessee really is what makes the cedar glades so. And if you could kind of picture the way a colleague and actually Mark, you mentioned Bertha Kritzberg, who was a friend of mine, the way that she would describe a cedar glade is they're like rooms. And so the flat part, the floor of the room would be the glade, the clearing. And the story of cedar glades is really about that clearing. And that's where we find these wonderful species of plants. And then the walls of the room would be the cedars. And the cedars, which they're not true cedars, they're junipers, they're
Right.
found all over the country. So
Yeah, what people commonly call Eastern Red Cedar
correct.
is juniper,
Virginiana. Yeah. So yeah.
Virginiana,
So and
right.
they're everywhere. But they they are adapted to this habitat, this hot, dry, wet, cool habitat year round, and they have the capability. This is the cedars to, their tap roots grow in and between and among those fissures, those cracks that are formed because limestone will dissolve when, of course, exposed to weathering and
Right.
rain.
Right.
And so really the glade is the opening, and then the cedars, of course, would be, if we think of it in terms of walls.
So if we take an aerial photo of Tennessee and we look at the so-called geographic provinces, we have the mountains on the east and the Mississippi River and the flatlands there on the west. In the middle, we have the the central basin of Tennessee,
The thumbprint,
right
yeah.
around it, the Highland Rim. But within that central basin is where these glades occur.
That's correct.
Generally, I guess there's probably some outside of that, but
There are, yeah,
yeah.
there's some in southern Kentucky, northern Alabama, southeast Tennessee. So we do see them at, but yeah, so picture that you've taken your thumb and pushed it into a rectangular rhombus right in the middle. Just push your thumb down, and there we are. There's the central basin. And so this exposed limestone is old. I mean, it's Ordovician age related, so it's incredibly old and composed of the calcareous remains of the bodies of once living things. And it's kind of interesting.
It was a ocean, a sea floor
Yeah, at
type of
two
thing,
separate times, exactly. And but shallow, because we don't find mosasaur, we don't find any big, huge fossils of big, enormous marine animals. We don't find those there, but we do find ammonites and shell-like and flatworm morphological fossils in that substrate.
And so where we have these cedar glades, we have plants that have adapted to the really pretty harsh climate in these areas. Very, very hot in the summertime, and wet in the wintertime. Tell us, and these plants have adapted to that.
Yeah, and it's there are those who have studied this more than I have, but it's intriguing to think about a couple of things. One is some of these plants are related to prairie plants, and so that's interesting. And then the other thing is the mechanisms that they have evolved to adapt to this particular system. And for example, January, February, we've got our little Nashville mustard. There's four different species of that occur here that are, it's like, hello, it's January, February, and these plants are blooming and they're extremely fragrant. They're very tiny, white, yellow, light purple, pink. But they're reproducing, they're providing pollen for our first pollinators that come out, when we get some of those January days in January.
So,
And
we've had our friend Joe Brichetto, who I know you are aware of,
yeah.
has been on this program a couple times, and we
Oh,
ta have
she's
talked about
so
the mustard.
great.
And of course, those mustards occur here in Davidson County
Yes.
on hillsides where they're open, exposed, oftentimes rocky areas. So.
Yeah, and the thing that's so interesting about them is they're getting it done soon. They're annuals, and so they make more of themselves each year from seeds. So they get all that reproducing business out of the way early in the very, very early spring. And then they go quiet, they produce their seeds, they go quiet. And then maybe later in the summer, the early fall, you can see their little leaflets, the little rosette. You can see that where they're going to be the next year. So it's just
And
incredibly
this is an
interesting.
example of a plant that occurs in the Nashville Basin
Correct.
and nowhere else in the world.
That is correct.
And that's a story of many of the plants that we see in our cedar glades around Middle Tennessee. And there's the interesting story, and we talked about the Tennessee coneflower, which is one of those plants that doesn't occur anywhere else. Can we talk a little bit about the history of the coneflower and how that was discovered and distinguished from other Echinacea species? And tell us more about that.
Okay, so this is Kim's rendition of it.
Okay.
And I had the privilege of being a student of Dr. Tom Hammarly. And backing up a little bit more from that, Dr. Elsie Quarterman was a Vanderbilt professor that came to teach at Vanderbilt because of the war. And so there was a shortage of faculty. And so she was invited to, or maybe applied for a job at Vanderbilt. And of course, then the war ended, and then she was invited to stay at Vanderbilt, which was wonderful. And she wanted to go on and earn a higher degree. And her professor, I can't think of his first name, but Dr. Ustine, he suggested to her, so she was looking for a project for her dissertation. He suggested to her, hey, why don't you just stick around Middle Tennessee and look at Cedar Glades? There's something really interesting going on over there. And so this is the early 50s, and that's what she did. So we give her credit. She was a plant ecologist of really taking, others have taken closer looks at glades, but this was part of her academic endeavor that she did. And so her students who came through her lab, this is what she put them on to, was studying, as you mentioned a little bit earlier, Mark, these plants that seem to only occur in cedar glades, and we refer to them as endemics. And there's more than 25 endemic species of plants that have been identified. And the Tennessee coneflower wasn't really part of the work that she was doing until she and a grad student, I want to say it was Barbara Turner, I may be incorrect, but it's the late 60s, and they're out driving around, Antioch, Mount Pleasant area. And, when you're a botanist, you're just looking at stuff anyway. Things catch your eye. These are beautiful, magenta pink flower we're talking about. So, and they're fairly large. I mean, the from petal to petal across the disc, it could be 3 or 4 inches.
Sure, the flower is large. Yeah.
And boing, it really catches
Right.
your eye. And so it stood out.
Right.
And so they drove by a place in Mount Pleasant and jumped out of the car, and then the ball started rolling from there. And again, if you find a plant, then you need to learn more about it and discover what its life history is, et cetera, et cetera. So part of Tom Hammarly's project was to do exactly that. And so there's a lot of good stories about how that went. But in order to study the plant, there's two ways that needs to be accomplished: in glass, so in a greenhouse, and then also in the environment. And so that's exactly what he did. So he figured out the life history of the Tennessee coneflower. And once that was known, then it was possible to proceed with propagating and, of course, protecting. And it's thought that the majority of the population went under Percy Priest Lake. It still was
Oh my
unique
gosh,
area,
really?
but yeah,
Wow.
but it's thought that there, of course, it was way more abundant, but lost to the water. And so it was determined. And what makes this so interesting is that it has to do with some of the adaptive features of the plant. First off, it's super hairy and bristly hairy, like a little bit unpleasant, like a black-eyed Susan, the hairy black-eyed, kind of
The
bristly.
leaves and stem are would
And the
be, right?
leaves are very narrow. The leaves are very much re they're long, but they're reduced in width. And then the petals are like if you've ever had an umbrella turn inside out on you. So the petals reflex upward instead of drooping downward, like you think about with the coneflower, like a badminton birdie. It's the opposite of that. And so some very distinctive things about this plant caught their eye. And so then, it was studied, and Tom would talk about, trying to dig this plant up. And, part of the adaptive feature is, of course, survival, super bristly hairy. It occurs in, this marginal zone between what we would refer to as a shrubby zone and then the open glade. it the roots though, the roots will just they'll keep going and going and going. And you know, if you're trying to dig in rock, it's you know, I think he broke a few shovels, you know, trying to successfully dig up this plant to bring it back to the greenhouse to study it further.
So when you and I had a chance meeting a few weeks ago, I guess about a month ago, at Cedars of Lebanon State Park, where they were having the annual native plant sale, the I guess the Wilson County Master Gardeners, but that's become sort of a traditional sale to go to.
Yes.
And we chatted just a little bit. And I remember chatting with you a little bit about my acquaintance, Paul Summers, who had been a botanist with the State Conservation Department back in the late 70s, early 80s. And my recollection from knowing Paul was that he was involved with this with the coneflower and getting it listed as an endangered plant. What do you know about that time and
Well, you know, the Tennessee coneflower was one of the first federally listed plants in the state of Tennessee.
right.
And the Endangered Species Act, and I may be misspeaking on the date, I think 1979 was when that was
That makes sense to me.
signed in. And
Yeah.
I think Nixon actually was the one who signed that into federal law. You know, Paul had. Again, he'd worked on, you know, many aspects of rare plants in Tennessee, you know, was thinking a lot about that. And so the coneflower was federally listed at that time as well.
Right.
And so we take you know, a plant that's rare and occurs in just a, you know, very few pockets of areas, and then we learn all about it. And then conservation groups begin transplanting it into suitable and protected habitat. And again, you know, from 1970 until t you know 2010, tw I want to say 2010, it was propagated each year very tediously. Flower heads, stems were counted one by one, and when the numbers were brought up to an appropriate level, it was possible to take it from the endangered to the threatened species list. And so that's what I'm talking about, people. That is a conservation success story.
Right.
Multiple agencies, thanks to Paul, were working together collaboratively, you know, thinking about how we could protect this plant.
So
And
interesting. So
it
interesting.
really is, and so exciting that, you know, what's possible.
So, Kim, your organization there at the university is involved with several aspects of this. You know, part of it is educational, part of it is research. Tell us about the educational part of that. What and I know if in, and I encourage people to go to your website. If you just go to Google and put in Center for Cedar Glade Studies, you're gonna see a great website, very robust with terrific materials. Thank you and your team for putting that out there. There's a lot of materials there for schools to utilize as lesson plans and that sort of thing. So tell us about the educational component of what you're doing.
Oh, and thank you for that for the compliment on the website. I'd like to give a shout out to Nancy Stetton,
You
who
bet.
is a she was a statistician for the state. She's since retired, but she's just a brilliant person. She set the framework up for that website and really basically did it as a volunteer. So I'm really grateful to Nancy. And the So my role, we were founded, quote unquote, in 2005, and this was through congressional funds that were part of, believe it or not, protecting wetlands. And you're probably going, wait, what? I thought you just said that these places are really dry. They're hot, 10 degrees hotter in, you know, in the summer than other
Right.
places, but it's standing water. in all winter. So, and you know, we have our winter rains, and because of the geology, it's standing water, and there are
Right.
species that are adapted to that as well. And so
Okay.
this warrants protection of them. And so I saw my role as really putting out to schools because, you know, and adults are enthralled learning new things, but you know, I really think that if you can reach children, then you've reached the future. And we've talked about Bertha Kritzberg. So she and I were part of a team that worked with an educator at the laboratory school at MTSU Campus School. And the teacher's name was Mary Lassiter. She contacted me and said, "Hey, Kim, will you help us work on a curriculum for the rainforest?" And I'm like, "Yeah, sure, we can do that, but why don't we let's just think locally." And the story began there 20 something years ago. We started thinking about Cedar Glades with her classes, and we worked together for many years. We called Bertha the grandmother of the
Oh
Glades.
yeah. Oh yeah.
And you know, these kids, you know, they're now in their late 30s, 40 years old, that we visited Cedar Glades. Murfreesboro is growing, so we're in Murfreesboro, grows
Right.
so rapidly. And there was a part of town that was we knew was going under development. So we asked permission from the owner if we could rescue, quote unquote, plants from that area that we knew they were putting like a beauty salon. I think now it's a gun range. And we did this for 8 years, where the students, the second graders at that time, we would go and rescue plants and bring them back to the school garden. And you know, we lost a lot of plants, but we also grew a lot of plants as well. And so these students were able to see the fruits of their labor, if you will, through the years that they were at campus school. So it's
Fantastic,
quite
fantastic.
wonderful.
So you are continuing in your outreach to elementary schools, middle schools, high schools.
I am. Now I have slowed down a little bit, but I've had the really unique opportunity to develop with a cadre of other educators materials that I can put in the hands of of formal and non-formal educators, and that really keeps the story going, because you know, you can't be everywhere all the time.
Right.
And have recently completed, in collaboration with many individuals, a limestone glade native plants guide. It's a little booklet that has some of the more common and the endemic and rare species that you can find in Cedar Glades. And so I think that this will be a useful tool as well, because we've got schools that are built around, and probably some of them even on top of, Cedar Glades.
Well, that's an interesting observation that had not occurred to me. Where can people get this little publication that you just mentioned, which you were kind enough to gift one to me when we met there in Wilson County recently? Where can people obtain that publication?
So right now there isn't a distribution network for this. This is
Okay.
a is all it's a 100% volunteer effort.
Okay.
And so Longhunter State Park and Cedars of Lebanon State Park have copies available for sale. And then whenever a outreach educator for the Tennessee Native Plant Society, if they're attending an event, they also will have copies for sale as well.
Okay.
But we don't really have a mech. It's not for sale on Amazon or anything like that right now.
Okay.
We're
Okay.
not
But
scaled
people
up.
can get that
We
if they want
can.
to get it at the camp stores or whatever at Cedars of
Right.
Lebanon and Longhunter State Parks.
That's correct. Yep.
Okay. Which is the focal point of the Cedar Glade areas, those two state parks.
That is exactly true. And Henry Horton has been in contact with me, so they will also have
Oh
some
good.
available too.
Oh good. That's excellent. Okay, so you mentioned just in passing your collaboration with the Tennessee Native Plant Society, and that's an organization that I like to support and promote. So tell us about your collaboration with that organization and what it does, and what your organization's relationship with the Native Plant Society is.
And I have been a member of the Native Plant Society for many, many, many years, and have been a steward of their Wildflowers of Tennessee book. And that was a total labor of love too. That was a volunteer effort. It was extremely expensive on the part of just getting it brought to publication. Lots of things, a little bit, some hiccups along the way. But I love, love that book. And actually, you can buy that, The Wildflowers of Tennessee. It's by Horn, David Duell, Tom Hammerly, and Tava Cathcart. It covers the entire state and then part of Appalachia, southern Kentucky, northern Alabama. So it's just a wonderful resource. And I wanted to be more involved with that organization. So I joined the board, and I was outreach educator, and now I serve as treasurer. But the relationship that the center has with the Tennessee Native Plant Society is just a natural marriage,
Right.
in that we spend time thinking about rare plants, species, conservation. Our focus is Cedar Glades, and then Native Plant Society would be the state of Tennessee. And the little booklet, with the exception of maybe something I've put in there, and there's one image that UT contributed, these images have all come from Dennis Horn, David Duell, Daryl Hess, Ranger Leslie Rollins, Alan Jason. Those names may all be familiar to you if you've ventured into the hip Cedar Glades of Tennessee. And
Which, by the way, there's a Facebook page
yes, that's
for
right.
everything in the world, of course, but
Yes.
there's one specifically for that's called the Hip Cedar Glades of Tennessee.
Is. That's
So
Jason Allen.
yeah,
Yeah.
so check it out, because Jason has his finger on the pulse of what's happening in the Cedar Glades community, and nowhere else will you find that inside scoop like you will on that little Facebook page.
It's so true. And then also George Wallace, who is an amazing photographer, he provided the species list. And Todd Crabtree, our state botanist. And then definitely not last and not least, Dennis Horn. So these are all individuals that I've had the privilege of working with and thinking about Cedar Glades, hiking with them with groups of people. And really just learning from them, because there's a great bucket of wisdom there.
So it's interesting, some of the people you mentioned, it's their job to do these things, and other people that you mentioned, it's a hobby or an avocation. So we do have a lot of so-called citizen scientists, people that may not have the formal training, but really have the interest.
And that's true. I didn't mean to leave her out, but I'm glad that you mentioned Margie Hunter,
Margie,
who
yeah.
also has a phenomenal book on gardening with native species. It's
Right.
wonderful. It's just a wonderful resource. And if you're thinking about planting native plants, it's just a great book to have in hand. She also is she's a phenomenal editor. And she's a naturalist, and I have to give her credit with being a really, really good editor on the booklet. So she combed through it and came back with multiple pages of corrections on that. Also, Milo Pine, who we have to really tell his story, right, Mark? I mean,
Tell it, tell
yeah.
it.
So Milo Pine is, at the time, he wasn't a botanist. But he was thinking a lot about plants, and I think he and his parents were riding around in Rutherford County, and happened to notice this plant that had bright red fruits, and it wasn't anything that he had ever seen before. So he reported it to the appropriate authorities, And which in turn the biologist who was the expert on kind of the generic plant genus, the astragalus group, said, wow, this is something new, something we haven't ever seen before. And this is the late 80s, and you think that we pretty much already knew everything.
Right.
And you know what? We really didn't. And so
He
the
discovered a brand new species, didn't he?
he
Yeah,
did. He
right.
did. And you know, subsequently there have been others as
And
well.
it's called Pines, what, sandwort
Ground,
or something?
no, it, well, that's a new pines ground plum. So it's
Ground plum, pardon
yeah,
me.
so
You're,
that's the yeah,
yeah.
Astragalus bilbulatus. But thinking about Margie Hunter and citizen science, so Margie, there's another species, it's the running glade clover, and it's a clover that the floret, you know, if life is good, is just a little bit smaller than a ping pong ball. So it's white, but it's the flower so much larger than, you know, the white clover you have growing in your yard. And Margie set up a series of research projects that was testing, again, just like what happened with the Tennessee coneflower, where can this plant grow? And you know, what's the life history of it? And so we have to give Margie a big shout out for that work. Recently, a 1 acre square plot natural area was established in Rutherford County to protect this plant because it's not found anywhere else other than the places that
This
Margie
particular clover
has
you're
begun.
speaking
Yeah,
of.
this
Okay.
clover.
Okay.
And so it's true. It you know, it really it takes more than a village to protect rare plants. And I was doing an interview a couple of months ago, and the question was, well, why do we care? And it's a good question, don't you think? I mean, you know,
Sure.
why do we care? Why do we want to put any time and money and effort into protecting these rare plants? And you know, if we want to make it about us, maybe there's something to that plant that will benefit us, you know, in terms of pharmacology. What is it like? One fourth of our medications are derived from plants.
Right.
And you know, and then just because it is, that's why.
What's the right thing to do? I mean, to me, waste is is one of the worst things that it's the cardinal sin. And so when you're not thoughtful about the land and what's on the landscape, you're wasting it. To me, and
Yes, I agree.
that's always an immoral thing to me. It may be my Catholic education, but waste is the one of the roots of evil. So there you go. That's my preaching for the day.
Well,
So.
and you know, the other thing is that we won't know what impact that plant had on the environment until it's gone.
It's if it's gone, it's gone. Development certainly is a threat to these areas as they are in Middle Tennessee, in Middle Tennessee's growing place. But what are the other threats to the Glades?
You know, it's incredible when we think about landscaping our modern homes and having plants that look nice and grow in a certain way and, you know, and stay a certain size. And we have introduced plants for that purpose that are they didn't evolve here. And so these introduced species are posing a great, these introduced plant species are posing a great threat. And not only the plant itself, I mean, there's no competition. It didn't evolve here. Sometimes there's nothing, there's no herbivory, there's nothing that feeds on it. It's able to grow rapidly, spread rapidly because there's no competition. And then actually encroaches upon our native natural heritage, our native ecosystems. accordingly. So I think introduced invasive species. Now, there's a lot of things we've introduced that haven't become invasive, but
Right.
specifically introduced invasive pest
So
plant.
just to take that in and break it apart a little bit. So we have a plant that's very common in our neighborhoods around Nashville called Chinese privet hedge. And it's, people, their hedge is out in front of your yard. That's the Chinese privet. Are we seeing that crop up in the Cedar Glades?
Oh, we absolutely are,
Okay.
and in prodigious numbers. It's,
Okay.
and you know what's really crazy, Mark, is that we have a native privet that it's deciduous, so it sheds its leaves in the wintertime, and it grows. It's a very it grows a little bit. What I would say the architecture is chaotic, but it is it's a beauty. It's just a beautiful, beautiful flowers. It also produces fruits. Very similar to the Chinese privet. And you know the Chinese privet, it's evergreen. It produces a lot of fruits. I mean, you know, if you've got deer, they don't
The
even
birds
eat
eat it
it.
and spread the seeds
Yeah,
around
but the
and
bird, primarily birds will eat it, will spread the seeds. So, and also bush honeysuckle is another huge problem. And you know, the list does go on and on. And if you're interested in that, the Invasive Pest Plant Council, they have a great website that lists some of these obnoxious plant species. And you know, the other thing is the plants that get introduced, they also have their own kind of relationships with animals as well. So they have insects on them that again, it's the same story. There's nothing that actually can combat the behaviors of that insect. So we've of course seen that, you know, insects and fungi as well.
So when these cedar glades are identified, they have to be evaluated in terms of what each of them individually have to be evaluated in terms of the threats that might be presented in each case. And there may be a landowner next door who's got a pig farm, and that's an issue. And there might, but there also may be just plants growing there that don't belong there that, if left to their own devices, would completely overwhelm that cedar glade in that natural condition.
That's exactly right. And what I've had the privilege of having happening this past spring is meet several landowners that are really interested in protecting their cedar glades. And myself and my colleague, co-director, Dr. Jeffrey Walk, we have both spent a fair amount of time responding to phone calls from people, you know, hey, do I have a cedar glade on my property? And you know, can you come look at it, or could you recommend somebody who can? And the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, there's actually an individual who this is what he does is he communicates with landowners that have rare plants on their land and helps them think a little bit more about how to manage that. So what you're talking about, Mark, is making sure that the invasives don't encroach. Because this is a system that is based on sun, and you know these plants that grow in and overtake, it's a huge problem. But you know, again, let's talk about the success story, places where they've been able to go in. Again, these species, they're fire adapted. The native species, they're fire adapted because that's what maintain glades. Because you're probably thinking like me when I first heard about this, well, ecological succession, it's a natural ongoing process. So what maintained glades? And
Okay, hold.
yeah.
Ecological succession.
Yeah, so
So that is where you have a prairie, and all of a sudden the trees come in, and then it becomes a forest.
that's exactly
All
right.
right, so
When one
that's
plant community replaces another.
okay. So
Exactly.
that's a term of art that it's worthy of explaining, because sometimes people are not aware. So.
Yes, and thank you for that
Okay.
clarification. And so maintaining a glade it's totally imperative that the out, that it's clear that there's not a bunch of shading that goes on. And so, fire was an important player in that. And
So
again,
from time to time, fire is used as a tool to maintain these areas.
exactly, controlled fire and places where this has occurred, the endemic species, they come back. So the seeds, actually, they haven't gone anywhere. They're just waiting. They've been what we call, they banked in the
In the
soil,
soil.
and there they are, just waiting and waiting. And that could be for, many, 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 many years.
So, Kim, are you a gardener yourself?
I am.
And
And
tell us, do you use native plants in your garden? And if so, how do you use them?
so I live in, probably like a lot of us, I live in a neighborhood with a homeowners association.
Oh, there you go.
And, these plants that are beautiful to us, the person in the HOA who drives around in their car and just kind of overlooks and sends out the nasty
Oh,
letters,
you're talking about Karen. Sorry.
oh yeah.
Karen.
Yes. That doesn't know anything about what's going on, and tries to evaluate what it is that I'm doing. But I'm nested in a neighborhood where people have the quote unquote bug guy comes and sprays
Oh,
everything,
gee.
and they're spraying for in the bushes and in the tree line and literally spraying everywhere. One individual was spraying the, I'm going to name it the Black Widow bug people, although a spider isn't a bug. I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Oh, I'm spraying for mosquitoes." And I'm
Right.
like, "Well, why are you spraying up in the trees?" And he's like, "Well, they're in the trees." I'm like, "Look, I've got five different species of nesting birds in my yard, and the mamas are coming over here and they're eating all these poisoned insects." And that year I only had really maybe one nest of I think wrens that actually came to bear. None of the others actually survived. And he said, "Well, I don't ever see any dead birds." And it's like, oh my goodness,
Yeah, gee
ecology
whiz.
101. He didn't understand it. And I get that. I'm not saying I don't get it, but so here's what I do is I garden with native plants within landscape beds. And right now they're stunning, they're beautiful. But in the wintertime, you need to leave all that. You can't
Right.
pull all that up because, well, the lightning bugs are in there, and that's and other things that are
They
really
overwinter in the stems of the plants and such as that, right?
exactly. And the native bees, there's more than 150 species of native bees, and I'm not talking about honeybees.
Right.
And then all kinds of other things as well. So what I do is I garden with native plants in landscape beds that are, they're cordoned off. And I have gotten a letter or two that something looked messy in the wintertime. But, then I just explained, it's not going to be like this forever. And I'm going to leave this. This is important.
It's part of your gardening practice,
It is.
exactly.
And what about you, Mark? I saw you at the native plant sale as well.
Well, you're going to have to come and visit us here in in the Green Hills area of Nashville. My wife and I have been focused on natives in our garden since about 2006 or so. We gardened before that without any thought to natives. Collecting plant materials from whatever, and I guess I came to learn about Doug Tallamy, and was inspired by what he wrote, and we decided to change our gardening practice at our house. So you'll have to come and visit. It's an extensive native garden here at our house.
That would be great. 20
Yeah.
years in the making too.
Right, right,
And
right.
that's the thing I've noticed, Mark, is gardening with native species, they have high resilience and they self-propagate quite well. And then you end up with plenty to share with your friends who become enthralled with what it is that you're doing. And I
Well,
don't need to use
exactly.
it.
And to me, it's a learning thing as well. I mean, you can buy any plant at the nursery that looks pretty and just plug it in a hole in the ground, but you're not learning anything about where that plant came from and the ecosystem that it developed within. And so we love our grasses, our carexes that we have in our yard and that are naturally occurring in our yard that we move and utilize in the in-between spaces in our garden. So the native gardening is a learning opportunity for us to learn about what we're seeing on the landscape and make sense of it. And why is this particular plant here, not there? And why does this occur in a at the beach in the sandy conditions? And why does this occur in a cedar glade? So gardening like that is a fun thing and a learning thing.
And it is true, like you. So coming back to the plant sale, if you're coming, they're everywhere. More and more, we see native plant sales throughout the state, which is magnificent. And the Tennessee Native Plant Society, we have on our website a list of places where you can purchase native plants as well. But the thing is when you buy them, they don't look like box store plants. They just look like maybe it's very, very small. And it could be that it'll be another season before you even get a bloom or some
Or it
type
gets to be a
of,
mature size,
or some type of rooting structure that's interesting. But protection and patience, I think, are really critical. And a rudiment of care when you first put anything new in the ground, you want to keep an eye on it. But it is amazing how well things have grown. And then my
So
neighbor.
we got some rattlesnake master
Oh.
at the native plant sale, and we went out there specifically looking for it because we have an area of our yard that we have in big blue stem and little blue stem. And we thought, well, if we wanted to have associated plants, prairie type plants, that would be a good choice. But as you say, we put it in, but you've got to kind of keep an eye on it to make sure it doesn't get overwhelmed when it's just getting started. We're learning about that, a new plant for us.
Well, and you're planting a native plant, so you've got other native species, animals that are very interested in that
You bet.
native plant.
You
So
bet.
I have an issue with rabbits right now. We have occasional deer, but it's really rabbits, so I have to protect everything because they're not necessarily eating, but they're sampling everything and.
We have a rabbit smorgasbord in our house, absolutely. So, Kim, we're going to have to wind up just here in a minute. But I wanted to ask you one last thing. If you were a citizen interested in learning about and seeing, exploring the Cedar Glades, where would you advise them to go and to get started in that?
I would really strongly encourage them to visit our state parks. We've got again, Henry Horton has Cedar Glades, Cedars of Lebanon, Longhunter State Park. These are all wonderful places that do have Cedar Glades. Even in Murfreesboro, the city, our Murfreesboro City Parks, which the system is, it's wonderful. There, we also have cedar glades that you can ask the naturalist there or the ranger at the state parks to guide you to. Again, you could read about them, and let's just talk. You could look in your backyard. I do many, many hikes, specifically at Flat Rock State Natural Area, and I meant to come up with the number. I listed that in the little booklet, but I'm just going to do this quickly. One, two, three.
Okay.
five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. So I have over 16 state parks and state natural areas that have cedar glades in them. So you can, Google that. When you go to the natural area, state natural areas, usually parking is limited and, you're on your own. There aren't always trails. And, some of them, it's a little bit precarious to get to.
If you plug into a particular park or natural area, let's just say Long Hunter, you will often become aware of, if you want to become aware of, programs that they have where they will with a ranger actually take you on a tour or a guided hike of these areas. So if you were just to show up at Cedars of Lebanon State Park with an interest in Cedar Glades, and you went to the visitor center there, and they'd give you a map, and you're on your own. That's a little bit daunting and a little off-putting, and I wouldn't recommend that actually for a beginner.
I agree.
The best thing is to do to get started with an organized hike of some sort, because the rangers in our parks and natural areas are just terrific and knowledgeable. And it really depends too on the season that you go. This time of the year, the glades are unfortunately loaded with ticks. And so you really have to be properly outfitted when you go into these glade areas. Not that you can't go in there this time of the year, but you have having a little bit of knowledge and someone coaching you about that is a good thing.
Yeah, and I completely agree with you on that as well. Yeah, you want to be prepared to be out in the quote unquote field. Again, water, you want to make sure that you're hydrated. You definitely want to know where you're going. There is an app, I believe it's called a Benza, that will literally walk you
Avenza.
through. Yeah, Avenza. I know at Flat Rock there you can do a 2 mile loop or you could do a 4 mile loop, and you would need to be prepared for that. But I wanted to come back to just taking the public out. I'm willing to do that from time to time, my schedule permitting. The Tennessee Native Plant Society also offers
Programs,
hikes.
exactly.
The Division of Natural Areas, they also have hikes year round that they will do. So I think if you're interested, you can find a way to get
Dynamite.
there. And then again, look in your backyard. I had high school students out at Flat Rock. This was several years ago, and showing them Pine's ground plum. And a student, she piped up and said, "Oh, I have that plant in my backyard." I'm like, "No, you don't, honey. There's only five populations of this that are known. You don't have it." She said, "I do." And I connected her with the Missouri Botanical Garden because they monitor Pine's ground plum. They do research on it. And sure enough, it was a new population
Oh my
that
goodness,
had been
that's terrific.
discovered. So it's look in your backyard too.
I love that. Kim Sadler, thank you so much for spending your time with us today on the podcast. It's been a joy to get to know you a little better and to hear about the exciting things you're doing there in Middle Tennessee State University.
Well, thank you so much.